And so I was talking to Lewis, or actually George, the other day, that we now have some of our funding which is going to expire at the end of this year, and it is time for us to send out new proposals. And not just because our funding is expiring, but also because apparently, because of Obama, there is now extra money
for research,
education, everything. So NSF is getting about $3 billion of new funding that it needs to spend soon.
Soon.
DOE is getting $1.5 billion that it also needs to spend soon. So we should be sending out proposals.
If getting more funded, I think that there will be more influx of international students, I'm sure.
Possibly, yes, but it's not too much money. I mean, we are talking about $3 billion, but a lot of it is towards, for instance, instrumentation programs, which is equipment and facilities development.
So it's infrastructure probably.
Not all of it is infrastructure. Substantial chunk is also research, and when we are talking about research money, then yes, students
so
will get more funding.
Time that it has to be wasted within this time period?
Yeah, so this is
not
wasted. Wasted. Wasted is V-E-S-T-E-D, that's what you want. Okay, so this money is a one-time money, and that is why they cannot create new programs based on this money. To create new programs, you have to have a continuous supply of money. This is not a continuous supply of money, it's just a fixed chunk.
Burst
of money, exactly. So they have to use it up quickly because the money can also go away just
so
as
what does that mean?
Thing.
Is that they are giving more money for the programs they have this year?
That's what it means, very likely. That
okay.
This, if for people who already sent in their proposals late last year, they are pretty lucky because when there are decisions that need to be made, right before that the money has come.
Mm-hmm.
So in the panel that I went to, typically they ask us to recommend up to 2 proposals. And this time, the program manager asked us to rank as many as 6 proposals.
Whoa!
6 proposals out of, 25 or something like that. So, but, I mean, that is assuming that they have additional money and they can fund as many as 6 proposals. So those who sent proposals late last year are in potentially lucky position.
Okay. Because now probably there's going to be more competition. But also more chance, probably.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk about, what you guys have in mind. And let's see if we can come up with something that can be converted into a proposal. Yeah.
Okay.
So who wants to start?
I can start. I guess for me it would be choice. Right? So rather than the new ideas, I have been thinking of more open problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have been trying to work in some problems, but. Like 1 week ago, I read some article, right, talking about the consumption, the power consumption of the SSD versus the other components of the machine. So it turns out that the SSD consumes less power than memory, actually. So I was trying to think how can we come up with some system, right, that take that advantage in order to save power. Like instead of having 4 gigs, let's say, of memory, right, now let's have 2 and add an SSD to the stack, something like that.
So
but
you want to use SSD like a SSD device?
No, but actually I think
could be, yeah. I don't know. I don't have a solution yet. But
okay, but doesn't, I think Windows Vista do that? Has something called, I don't know.
Ready Boost.
Ready Boost or something like that.
The Ready Boost is, actually it's for saying
for expanding swap.
In
right?
Windows, no, no, in fact, in Windows, there is something called RediBoost that do something like that. Actually, RediBoost is that you have your flash device, but you know, small. I guess the target is key USB, right? And the idea is that you the goal is to increase performance more than increasing power. Or saving more power. So the idea is that you load in that USB key, popular data, and you now instead of going all the way down to disk, now you can load your data from the USB key. So my project is more about saving power, and in fact, what I think we can do is to, but I don't know how to do it, right? Because you cannot buy hardware. You cannot say, okay, turn off these memories. Let's say. So that means that you should.
You can take out, right?
Yeah, you can take it out. But I don't know. That could be inconvenient, right?
But
so,
you cannot dynamically change memory.
No, but well,
exactly. That's what I'm saying. But you know, you can take the memory out, right? So I don't know. So something like that. So probably one project would be comparing after I have the system, compare the cloud consumption of the normal disk with all its memory and also performance, and then take some memory out and see where it's going. Power thing. Yeah.
So
that's nice. I like that.
So one thing is that the thing is the way to access the devices is different, right? So memory, you access it from boards to whatever you want, and SSDs are typically from a page.
That's true. But, you know, I guess we have to work around that somehow.
No, but you're talking about using the SSD as a backing store for RAM.
I guess it's more like a...
I mean, it's like a swap.
It's like a swap, yeah.
So if you have a swap, then you can always swap in pages of memory as required dynamically. And the argument is that we are trading off performance, memory access performance, for power consumption.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff that we are doing with CRU directly applies here.
Yeah.
Because all the data is in memory. So you can always write sequentially to SSD.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So I think the typical scenario, right, you have the swap partition anyway, right? Because you have memory and it's small in amount, so to back up with the memory, you have a swap partition. So now with the SSD, because the access to disk is very, very slow, so now you can leverage the performance of SSD as a swap partition. So that will save both your power as also somehow balance the access time.
Right.
So, yeah, so actually I guess we can come up with some, you know, mathematical model of how would be
how
the
you
performance
to,
and power
sure.
saving.
So are you sure you cannot, I mean, the memory doesn't have any power saving thing?
I don't know, because I haven't checked that, I haven't Googled for it. But
let's say you're not using
I'm assuming you cannot.
Memory bank, you can.
Probably you can, I don't know. But,
yeah, the only thing I know is that the more...
I didn't get the last part of the conversation. So.
Oh, okay. So he's saying that if there is some way to dynamically turn off some parts of the memory, like saying, okay, I want to turn off this bank of memory, right? So we can make this dynamically instead of having to switch off the machine and take the memories out. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
In some processes you can do it.
In some processes you can do it?
Yeah.
You can turn off memory?
Yeah, on those power sticks you can do that.
Okay.
What?
You can, those IBM power sticks, you can do
Power
you can throttle the bandwidth, you can do
everything. Yeah, but those are fancy processors. I don't know if on
86
probably you cannot.
And
that's fine.
Most likely not. Yeah. But probably,
And those machines are targeted for what? Data centers?
Yeah, and the other thing is that RAM memory consumes power constantly, even if you access it or not. And
exactly.
And the other thing is that what if you access it, is it consuming more power than if it's idle?
I mean, there is a base power usage for memory, but an accesses won't do much. But what will increase the amount of memory you use is
right.
Is the stall cycles. I mean,
is it what?
I mean, there is a base and there is power per there is additional per X.
Per access. That includes reads and writes.
I don't know. I'm not sure. But there is a relationship between bandwidth and power. The more you use memory, the more, and it's linear.
No, but you... No. Okay, I get your point. Because, of course, you have more memory, so you have to refresh more bits. But the thing is that...
I know there is a base. I mean, even if you don't use it, you will be, you have some power consumption. But as you increase the use, I mean, the amount of the bandwidth, stuff you read and write per second, you will...
So I guess there is some penalty for accessing.
Yeah, and it's high. It's comparable to CPU.
Because programming might actually take more power than just refreshing, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So it could be something along those lines.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what kind of physical the
architecture
keeps the RAM view? Is the schema?
Yeah. Though I'm not an expert at RAM technology, but I'm guessing it
should
be
some
kind
of space. So and the SSD, they use NAND most of them. Both are semiconductor chips, but how come they be different in power consumption?
But the other difference, key difference, is that SSD or NAND flash is persistent,
mm-hmm.
and RAM is not.
So you don't have to refresh, right? For instance.
Mm. So that's another difference. But I think the underlying technologies are should be quite different than each other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would be good to know more about this technology from a hardware standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of like this idea for trading off performance for power.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this paper called Gordon, the one that I forwarded to you. Basically, they are arguing along similar lines, saying that instead of using the most powerful CPU that you can buy and the maximum amount of RAM that you can buy, let us have slower CPUs, very little RAM, and flash, no disk, and have more of these guys. So construct an array of such.
Well, actually, that was also what the I remember the keynote in HPCA talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
he said that basically, if you underclock a CPU, you're using like 80% less power.
Yeah, apparently.
And just decreasing performance by 20%.
The power consumption, instead of increasing linearly, increase more like.
It's exponential. Well, I don't know if it's exponential, but it's not linear.
Yeah.
Quadratic
or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably quadratic, I think.
No, but this is a very interesting idea worth pursuing. But the challenge would be, so one of the things that I was thinking about is the interface to the flash, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are talking about new interfaces.
Okay.
Why use block interface and be tied to the same interface that disk uses?
Mm-hmm.
So, in this sort of a hybrid memory architecture, there was another paper as well in ASPLOS, which where the title was something about flash and RAM.
Yeah, I have it somewhere in the RAM.
Flash and RAM, yes.
Flash and RAM.
Yeah. It was something about simulating you might want to take a look at that as well. Look at the ASPLOS.
But I checked the program of ASPLOS, but I just found two
It's EuroSys. It could also be EuroSys.
I didn't check EuroSys.
Okay, check EuroSys.
Okay.
Because those are the two programs that I've been looking at recently.
Okay.
But I don't remember any flash in EuroSys. Probably short papers.
I don't think it was a short paper, but anyway, there was a paper which talked about simulating memory using flash or something like that. But here, I think there are people rapidly moving into this space as well, especially with the Gordon idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is sort of along similar lines that we want to move to a low power architecture. But you are saying that since flash consumes less power than memory, maybe we can use flash, a hybrid memory architecture
mm-hmm.
with RAM and flash.
Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's certainly interesting.
Yeah, I guess another thing that you can do with that is do very fast hibernation and suspend.
That's true, yeah.
And it would be very, I mean, suspend will not consume power.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember where I read it, but I heard that there are some type of flashes where the processor can fetch instruction directly from flash.
Okay.
That, in that case, you don't even need to simulate.
Right.
I don't know what's the name of the X.
But it was a paper or what?
No.
Some company.
For sale.
Oh, for sale.
Yeah.
Oh, so you mean the flash that has a different interface? Probably that's what you mean.
Yeah, but
yeah,
the processor
yeah, because the processor can
fetch
instructions
directly. It should
yeah.
have a different interface.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess the problem with that is the size of the FTL, right?
FTL?
Yeah, that's when the
flash.
Ah,
okay.
Because that's the reason they usually use 4K entries in the FTL.
It might be good, certainly a direction that's worth exploring.
Yeah.
It seems to make a lot of sense from power standpoint. Question is cost. I mean, how do we deal with the cost? If cost per gigabyte of flash versus RAM, I'm guessing there is an order of magnitude difference there as well.
I don't know, but...
So we have to sort of make this effective access time computation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Effective memory access time if you have a hybrid memory architecture.
Right.
And so there is a probability that your access can be on RAM
or
it can be on flash.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is how do you increase the probability of accessing to RAM?
Mm-hmm.
That could be one way of optimizing this because accessing flash is slow.
Right.
Also, there is also questions about how you make this architecture. Do you use the flash simply as swap or can you use it as a primary memory that can be accessed directly?
Well, I guess you can treat it as a multi-level cache, right?
That would be a swap architecture. So if you have RAM and then backed by, so that's one architecture, but based on what Ricardo is saying, that if you can directly fetch data from flash into CPU, then you can bypass RAM as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an alternate architecture that would be explored.
Yeah.
Is there any work on data recovery based on swap content?
Data recovery?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean, not only recover the state of the process after a crash based on the swap, but I don't know, maybe processes could implement some interface where based on data on swap, you could reconstruct some stuff from disk to, I don't know, something like that.
I don't quite understand.
Yeah. It's not clear at all. It's just an intuition that if there is a crash, you have some information on swap space that can be used for recovery, to restore some data that might be inconsistent. Okay.
Yeah, well, the thing is that probably what's in swap space is what's less meaningful to recover than what's on memory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right now you couldn't do it with what you have on swap, but you could enforce process to put other stuff in swap, yeah.
You mean synchronously?
Or not necessarily, or...
Say you need to have important things backed up or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you are doing now?
Yeah.
He's doing
okay.
Persistent memory.
Okay.
So we need to sort of communicate
okay, yeah.
a little better because that's the whole idea behind the project that George is doing.
My point is, let's say with regular swap,
uh-huh.
you boot the machine again and you don't do anything with swap. That's information that could be used for anybody.
Right now, right?
Yeah. That there is information there. What can that information be used for?
You mean like a memory snapshot?
Maybe like a memory snapshot, or maybe to reconstruct something. I don't know.
Yeah, so really the thing is that the structure that handles the swap is on-memory structure.
Yeah.
So you would need to keep an on this version of the swap. I mean, on this data structure that handles the swap.
Yeah, okay, so metadata on top
because,
of the swap.
Because right now, I mean, those pages are
don't mean anything.
They're just pages of memory, but you don't know what they mean.
The other thing is that the contents of the swap do not represent a snapshot of the system.
Yeah, of course, because these pages don't need to be the complete address space of a process. It's just pages that are not used.
Right.
But that's information that's somewhere. It could be used for something. Well, actually, maybe not. I mean, I don't know. Or even if it's not used for anything good, it could be used for bad things, at least.
For bad things?
I mean, no, for...
for evil things.
Evil things.
You mean by... because of security? Or
yeah, because of security. I don't know. Because nobody do anything with subspace. Right?
Well,
you would and you don't even clean. You just start writing
the thing
all over
is what I told you, because you don't know what's there. I mean, that could be just... you don't have any process information associated with each swap page. And,
you know,
and that's hard to deduce.
Yeah, it's hard, but there is some information. It's not encrypted or anything. It's as is, right?
That's true. I mean, I would certainly. It seems interesting to explore. And in fact, you could also say that I'm going to store additional information so that the swap data becomes usable.
So probably that will bring more security contracts.
Yes, I don't know.
No, but I think it's an idea that I would not dismiss right away. I would think more about it. Certainly an interesting thought. I mean, we don't have an idea yet.
No, of course.
It's just
there is some information that could be used for something. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
Right.
So what do you typically have? What kind of information do you typically have in the swap partition? It's just
pages that you were not using.
Just page contents, right?
Yeah.
That are not being used.
I'd say the least recently used pages.
And who tracks those pages?
Who tracks
the operating system?
Which is
the page, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's the virtual memory system that does that. Page cache is also used by the file system.
Yep.
So
the page cache maintains the value of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, actually, the page cache will not handle it. The page cache will just access the page and it will get a page.
Virtual memory system knows, right, that which position of the swap partition the page is being swapped off.
Yeah, it needs to keep track of all that information because eventually it needs to maybe have to load it back into memory. So it needs to know where it put it so it can load it back. This is something you already built in Nature, so you should know how this works. I hope you were the one who did that. Okay, so Ricardo, I would ask you to dig that information where you found that the CPU can directly access flash.
Okay, I have. It was one of those kind of links, like Linux Magazine, something like that. You know, clicking. Oh, I didn't know you can do it. And then
you lost it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was X something. Yeah.
Can you try to find it?
Sure, of course.
Yeah. If you can find it, that would be helpful because that's something which can potentially be used in a proposal.
Okay.
Now, this idea I like. For the Hekura call, they are certainly looking for high performance. And power is a concern, but performance is a bigger concern. But if we can say that, well, we can build a cheaper system, right?
Well, but if you're using flash, it's not necessarily a cheaper system.
No, flash is cheaper than memory.
Yeah.
So I can build a cheaper system and put two nodes for the same amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the overall performance
will be higher. You save not only in memory, but also in power, right?
You mean cost?
In the cost, yeah, I'm talking about the cost, or money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the fast access time that makes memory so expensive, right?
Yeah, I guess so. That I don't know if the access time makes it expensive, but the technology that needs to be in place to give you that access time. And that, yeah, you could think of other devices that are cheaper and give you the same access time. Eventually, maybe such devices. And the current technology of RAM is what makes it expensive.
Because the prices of RAM never goes down that much as the extent of the permanent storage.
Yeah, well, one other thing that to consider there is that now you're going to be modifying the contents of the flash more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a fixed amount of lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
So probably you need to do some wear level mechanism. Well, yeah, but that's...
I don't know. You can't rely... That depends on how you do it, because the FPL usually takes care of that.
Okay.
Right? So, but... It could be that,
yeah, but I mean,
that you don't use an FTL, right? Even.
I don't know.
Why not?
But I mean, it's something to take into account. That,
mm-hmm.
that, I mean, it's not the same as random RAM that you
can of course.
Access it and modify it how many times you want. Here you have a.
But if you are using a flash for a, just for memory purpose and not as a permanent storage, you can just, if after a certain time, you can just replace it.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to say, that probably, I mean, flash is decreasing, the price of flash is decreasing very quickly. So by the time that wears out,
you can
buy double, data. Probably by the same price.
You won't lose any data because it's just for memory, it's not permanent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
How big are the caches on the flashes?
The cache, you mean the RAM they have, like the buffer?
Yeah.
It's usually 16 megs, more or less.
Megs?
16 megs?
In accessing one of those.
But you know that actually I also read that this already has 16 megs, more or less.
Yeah, actually some have 32 even.
Yeah.
A lot of
them have
more.
But the seriality?
Typically 16 or 32. Depends on how much you pay.
And so accessing one of these is limited by the bus bandwidth, right?
Accessing one of what?
I mean the buffer cache. I mean the cache of the device.
Okay, what happened?
It's slower than accessing actual memory.
Oh,
it's limited by the bus or
by
limited
the bus.
By this thing?
Yeah.
By the bus.
By the bus.
But I guess operating system doesn't directly talk to the cache of the disk, right?
No, but
it's a disk controller.
Right?
Disk controller.
Yeah, it's a controller which
Okay, now this is an interesting idea, certainly. So far we've been talking about or looking as flash to be used more as a cache for disk,
mm-hmm.
not really as a hybrid memory storage alongside of RAM. So that's sort of, so if earlier flash was here and disk was here and the RAM was up there, now we're saying move this closer here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, certainly there is space in this region to think about different architectures.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Okay.
So far it's only hybrid storage, hybrid memory.
Right, but I think, I don't think people have really looked into hybrid memory yet, but it's probably worth exploring. You know, there are concerns about wear leveling, right, lifetime. There are also concerns about access times, how much does RAM access time degrade, things of that kind. And what sort of architecture should be used? Should I be using this simply as a swap or something more interesting where I can access the flash directly from CPU, right? So there are quite a few interesting questions there. I think if I saw a paper like that today, I would want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good. So Lewis, I would certainly encourage you to think more about this.
Mm-hmm.
And to sort of try to make it more formalized.
Okay.
And to do some back of the envelope calculations if possible. To come up with some initial numbers to see if it makes sense. from cost and performance standpoint.
Right.
Also power. So there is a lot of these three different optimization metrics.
Performance, cost. Because actually we were doing some of those numbers this morning, right?
Me?
No, we remember we said accessing a page from Flash takes about at the same time that accessing a page from RAM, according to our calculations.
That's in a way
only true.
For
read,
So
but I guess the bottleneck is the bus. The bus, I mean the bus between the controller and the host.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is that still is copied to RAM.
Yeah.
So you need
if
Raju said
access to Flash, then it would improve a lot, right?
Yeah.
So right now how is it the access goes on?
As what?
How right now how the access goes to the Flash?
Through the serial key controller, right? Like this is
okay.
So the SSD implements the CLTA protocol again, and you can talk with a normal device driver.
There is though the Fusion IO drive.
Oh, there are
which exposes.
It's a memory card, right?
That's a
PCI card.
PCI Express, I think.
Yeah, PCI Express card. Though it's probably accessed through block device driver anyway.
Probably the device driver is for some kind of block.
So that would certainly be. I mean that Fusion IO interface and what Ricardo was talking about. Mm-hmm. I think both need to be taken into account.
But I guess that also has an FTL, right? So it's also probably a block device.
I don't know. Yeah.
That's my guess because they use it like a persistent store.
They use it exactly as
a drive,
like a normal flash.
Okay, so we should talk more about this, maybe at FAST.
Okay.
Okay, so Ricardo, you were talking about this idea for
using swap.
How can we use swap?
Yeah.
How can we use all the junk in swap?
Yeah, for something good or
something
bad.
Useful.
Or something evil.
Like what you want.
Or how could you protect yourself against? I mean,
there are solutions to encrypt having a swap, right?
Yeah, you could just encrypt. Yeah, that's easy. Yeah. So,
so probably good things is better to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would certainly encourage you to spend more time thinking about it.
Not just for
reliability, maybe performance. You can boot faster. Something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking that probably.
But how can you boot faster?
I'm not sure.
Because you still have to either you access the disk and you read it from the disk, or you read it from the flash. But
yeah, but probably you can do some kind of Borg-like optimization, right? You trace all the sequence of files you have in the disk and have that in the swap somehow.
No, but the boot
so
is
now
from a specific portion of the disk.
But Borg already does that. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's borrow.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, probably there's something.
But booting is always from a specific portion of the
disk.
Of the disk, yeah. But see, if you go through a block, to access that specific portion of the disk, if you go to the block device driver and that performs an indirection, it's still okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, for example, one thing that could be done is instead of just swapping out things that you consider not important, you can swap, well, I mean, not used, you can swap out things that you consider that you should be keeping safe.
So it's more aggressive swapping.
No, completely change the swapping.
The swap philosophy.
Yeah,
yeah.
Swap philosophy.
You not only swap.
So
swap
right now, and the other thing is that probably you have to swap whole processes, not pages. Not individual pages, but whole processes. Because if you just swap pages, then probably the overhead due to seek are horrible.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Well, think more about it. I think this has to be thought in isolation.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have anything else, Ricardo, that was sort of what you had to say?
About this? That's it. There are some other ideas.
Okay, okay. Let's have George say what he has to say, and then we can come back to you later.
Let me see. So like Riley said, in the persistent memory project, one of the things that we have, so we have this sort of modular system where we do most of the work in one level, and then have this other component that optimizes depending on the underlying device.
Okay.
Right? So what I was thinking is that, okay, so from my point of view, in the next 5 years or so, there are going to be in the market much more devices persistent devices than what exists today. There are just simply this hard drive, solid state flash, and probably we can include those RAM-based solid state drives, right? So my thing is having this additional indirection layer that optimizes accesses to the underlying device, right? So now having this sort of file system that automatically knows which are the underlying device, probably, let's say, it was also inspired on the CFS idea, right? So you have multiple devices, and probably they're hybrid devices. So some are mechanical drives, some are flash-based SSDs. Probably you have some other technology that's not yet available, and each of them have different characteristics, right? So the idea is just having this file system that automatically adjust its layout and its configuration of files for each of the underlying devices, right? So basically, something in the lines of that.
Do you want to do that at the block level or a file system level?
Probably a file system level, because what I was thinking is that. The thing is that I'm not sure, because current file systems are optimized for only for mechanical drives, right? So, and like I said, my guess is that in the next 5 years or let's say 10 years, we're gonna have in the market, I'm sure that there are gonna be at least three or more types of SSDs apart from flash.
Mm-hmm.
So the file systems are not going to be able to keep up with this array of devices, right? Because we have, for the last 30 years or so, file systems have been focused on optimizing for the way mechanical drives work, right? And we need to have now a file system that changes depending on how the underlying device works. So now not just considered a mechanical drive, but probably a flash drive. Probably you take one out and put another one in. So in some other sense, it's like having this self-managed file system.
So isn't this self-managed file system just then, can I break it down into designing one file system for each type of device? I mean, one file system designed for each type of device.
Well, the thing is that it's not only that, but it's what information you put in each device.
I mean, what sort of data?
Yeah, I mean, that's a component, because like I said, that's just one component that tells you, okay, so this device, the best way to access it is if, let's say, if you do sequential,
I have one basic question. So what you're saying is to have same file system or same instance of the file system using all the devices, or not?
The same file system that sort of adapts itself to the devices that are below it. Right, so probably what the file system will do is just profile the device somehow, and from that profile, it can make a fingerprint of what type of device it is. And from there, it can automatically know its performance characteristics based on some model, and that way improve its layout and that sort of stuff.
But why use one file system to do all the stuff? I mean, I would rather use the VFS and make use of other file systems that is specifically tuned for specific devices.
Then you will need to do the allocation by hand yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be nicer It would be nicer. I mean, it would be great if, let's say, I have my disk, my flash, my something, and I see the whole thing as a single device.
Okay.
And then I have a file system mounting in this whole thing, and the file system will allocate blocks intelligently based on the characteristics of the devices or whatever. It will have a specialized type of file, so the scheduler that schedules requests to all of these. Yeah, I guess that would be very nice. That would be.
Yeah, exactly. Also.
That would be very nice.
Schedulers that correspond.
So a way of abstracting this would be something like you have a linear space
you have
the whole linear space, but you have ranges of.
Or not necessarily ranges. Could be, let's say, extents, because.
Yeah.
We have segments that. Well, yeah.
You have segment ranges, whatever, that says this is faster or something than this, and this is something than this.
Yeah. Probably you place metadata. I mean, there are many, many open questions.
Yeah, that would be great.
But
the thing whole thing.
But probably that the most motivating example is what Ricardo just said, that now the person doesn't have to worry about where to place each file. But the file system will take care of them.
So this wouldn't be like an extension to what CFS does, right? CFS in some sense.
Yeah, probably. Probably you can consider that.
Do this kind of.
Yeah, that's why I said that it was in some sort of fire by CFS and
because CFS you just said I have
this pool of this mm-hmm.
and CFS does something like that. You don't have to specify
what
to do with it.
Well, I guess they don't have to do all this, right? Whatever block device you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But, what you're saying is that CFS, let's say, would potentially also take into account what device is the one that is underneath, so now you can have some optimizations, right, for that.
So specifically, this would mean designing an allocation algorithm for this and designing a different scheduling algorithm for this. That would be basically the two things, right? Because the idea of merging.
Well, it would be, you need to design a meta allocation algorithm that takes into account how many instances of each device you have, capacities, and all that.
Yeah.
Right? And then you will need to design individual allocation algorithms for each of the devices, and then individual schedulers for each of the devices.
Now, how does the file system know access patterns? Or is it going to be as simple as saying that, well, small files should be on flash and large files should be on disk? Or can we do something more intelligent than that?
Well, right now the inodes keep track of some information. You can probably extend the inodes to keep track of other information, because right now it's very poor. It's like last access or something like that.
Last access time, last modified time.
Yeah, last modified time.
Mm-hmm.
Probably we can, let's say, do some extension of the inodes to incorporate additional information to derive access patterns.
There are more things. For example, you wouldn't put your journal in the flash disk, right? In the flash device, or
you could. I mean,
things that are more blocks that are highly read but not written that much, you would not put in a flash. And I guess there are many things that are
usually
clear, right? Many rules.
People want
clear.
To use the journal in the flash because it's faster and you use it all the time.
But write is not fast.
Then you just replace it.
No, but the thing is that you write to it sequentially.
Oh, yeah.
To a journal, right? You access it randomly, but you write to it. Well, you may access it randomly, but you actually write to it sequentially.
Oh, no, but my point was that there might be clear rules or it might be not that complicated to come up with rules to say you should put this type of blocks here or there.
There was one paper that we read about that dynamically maps files to different file system types, right?
Yeah.
So if it's a file, a small file, then put it in an EXP3 file system.
Yeah, hybrid.
Remember, something of that.
That was in
that was submitted to FAST.
The mini PC, right?
Oh, but I guess they just said they just proposed the idea.
They didn't have an implementation, and their idea was different than what you're proposing. They're saying, well, map files dynamically to file system types. You're saying map files to device types.
Yes.
Right? Now, so we have this other project called Hybrid Storage Device, which we put on hold for a while. Now Rick is going to, starting that again. And the idea was, in a way, to do the online learning of what data should be where at the block level in a simple version of the problem where you have a single disk or maybe a RAID and some flash. And how do you migrate data or use this all these devices as a unified space at the block level?
Yeah, so my point is that, okay, so we don't have to restrict ourselves to just mechanical drives and flash. Because there are going to be, well, my opinion is that there are going to be a lot more types of solid-state devices coming in the next few years. So we need to have this thing that automatically maps, I mean, probably does profiling of the device and identifies which are the performance characteristics of the device. For instance, let's say it does some profiling and it says, okay, this device has fast sequential access, slow random access, and it has this C curve that looks like a disk, so probably it's a mechanical drive. Or let's say from the C curve you can already infer some information, right? And the flash, you can also have a C curve that fingerprints the device as a flash device, right?
No. I mean that is something which may not be so important, because when you mount the file system, you can specify things like device type. So that can be manual information. So I think the profiling
Probably
the profiling itself is not so critical. The second comment is that there might be more than just disk and flash in the future, but that doesn't mean that you will have all those devices within one system.
That's
so
true.
You could be using, you know, this new kind of phase change memory in some other class of systems than you would use in servers. So I think, to me, it seems like the a more practical route to take would be to design a file system for each device type. And to do something like what you're saying, you could have a VFS layer indirection mechanism which says, okay, go to write this file to SSD file system, write this other file to disk file system. So you have multiple instances of file systems, each of which is tuned for a specific device, and then you remap or...
Yeah, but the thing is, what if you, for instance, let's say, okay, I want the metadata to be somewhere, and then the data to be some other place, because, let's say, metadata is accessed more frequently or whatever, right? Or let's say, if you have access pattern, you say, okay, this part of the drive of the file is accessed more frequently than this. So probably, let's say you can have something like a Borg-like thing going on in the file system to automatically do that, to have multiple copies of the file, or I don't know, that such as the blocks are in a different order or something like that.
So for instance, frequency-based partitioning and things like that could also be done at the block level, right?
Yes.
Also, splitting a file into multiple chunks can be done at the block level. Yeah, I'm just trying to think how. I mean, developing file system is a very complex effort, right? So we are thinking about a futuristic scenario where on a single device you have multiple different types of files, multiple types of devices, and then interesting problem of designing a file system that can leverage all these devices simultaneously. So a lot of things need to fall in place before a system, a file system like that becomes usable.
But I guess the use of GFS is more easy to indirect different operations to different.
That seems to be a more practical way to go, because anyway you will have to design file systems for specific types of devices, because each device may have a different access characteristic. So I would, you know, design a file system for SSDs or design one.
Right now you use the same file system for disk as well as SSD?
Yeah, more or less that's the case. I mean, we are using all the file systems that were developed using disk in mind, now in flash.
But
there are some file systems which seem to be more suitable for flash, like lock structured file systems.
Yeah.
But they were developed with disk in mind originally.
So in storage, file system layout is different for different type of devices?
No. At least for the current file systems, that's not the case. So if you design new file system that is specifically for flash, then you would design simply for flash, which would not work very well with disk. Right? So that's the direction I'm proposing, which is to design file systems tuned to specific device types.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, probably my argument is that if we just develop this sort of interface to this small, let's call them, device module, let's say we develop this mini file systems that know just how to place a set of blocks in a file or let's say a file in a device. I mean, it doesn't have to be like this huge file system that takes into consideration every case.
Mm-hmm.
Just this mini file system that basically provides a rule that the file consistency rules. I say that what you write is what you read. It doesn't have to be a whole complex file system that provides let's say recovery guarantees and all that. Because that can be provided by the meta file system.
So isn't that like a block device optimization? That you send it some blocks, it will give you the same blocks at a later point.
The thing is that probably it's a block device optimization, but you would have to know some semantic information about the block.
So then it's part of the file system.
Then it's of the file system, but my point is that it doesn't have to be like this complete file system that I don't know. I don't see it that difficult to.
So you talk about you are basically referring to some module of the file system,
mm-hmm.
which let's say does either allocation or maybe journaling or something like that. So those are. So you're saying create interfaces to the file systems to attach modules that do file system tasks now in a specific manner to devices.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because the file system itself already does most of the job. You just have to know how to more efficiently access the device and all that.
Mm. So the question then is, what are the file system tasks that are device dependent, and how do we separate those out and form this minimal interface? Just like the VFS has an interface to attach file systems, this would be an interface used inside file systems to attach device specific file system modules, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, in other words, you're also arguing that it is not necessary to redesign the entire file system for flash.
Yeah. Or for other devices.
Or for any other device. There are some modules within the file system that are device dependent and others are not and can be reused
mm-hmm.
in exactly the same way. I mean, that's interesting from a software engineering standpoint and also probably from a research standpoint also. But the key question is, what are these functionalities that are device dependent? What are the key functions? I mean, what I would do is list all the functionality that the file system provides and implements, and then go through each of them to find out which of these can potentially be device dependent. And
certainly allocation.
Allocation is one thing which certainly seems to be device dependent, but also
I know structure,
like
metadata, how they persistently keep metadata.
Yeah.
Well, my guess is everything that depends on that basically depends on the layout is independent of it's dependent on the type of device.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you talked about several different possibilities. One is to build this mega file system that is exposed to all the underlying devices,
mm-hmm.
right? And maps blocks to these different devices based on their characteristics.
Right.
And the other one is to create this sort of new interface to file system so you can attach device-specific implementations.
Well, for me, that's just a way to accomplish the other one.
No, but there are two parts, because one has to do the mapping between...
one has to...
But that those may be mutually...
No.
I mean, they may be conflicting, actually.
So the way that I thought about it is that... So we have this... Let's say this meta file system,
mm-hmm.
that knows which underlying devices. Let's say it has a pool of devices, and it knows the characteristics of each of these devices, and it decides where to place what part of the file. Probably it can replicate files. That depends on, let's say, some user policies or whatever, and then that file system has modules that know how to best place data, and so that it can they can both be probably accessed let's just say how to best place data on each type of device. And even you don't even have to have a pool of devices. Even if you have just file system that has one device. So like you said, it would in some sense be a sort of interface provided by the file system to develop layouts for this thing, device types.
Hmm.
Because the idea is not just to go and re-implement all these file systems and every time a new device comes up.
Hmm. Hmm. Okay. Yeah. I personally don't know which way would be more appropriate. To me, it seems natural to think of building a file system for a specific device. But I do see you do have additional flexibility if you build a file system that can manage more than one device. There is an additional degree of flexibility there. For such a file system, you do need at least two devices, two different device types, for it to be useful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is it is an interesting direction, though.
But even if you are building a new file system for a specific device, you are not rebuilding everything as a file system. You probably will do some changes in the file system to be more appropriate for the device.
I mean, if you go through this exercise of creating this new interface, then you also will be forced to identify which parts of the file system depend on the device. So in that sense, I think that modular approach is worth pursuing.
Mm-hmm.
because at the very least you will understand which portions of the file system require device knowledge, right? More detailed device knowledge, and especially what assumptions are being made because it was a disk before, and now those assumptions do not hold anymore, and you need to think about new ideas to implement those parts of the file system.
Are there any other file system like CFS where you have this pool of devices and CFS just puts all the data in those things?
Well, RAID, right?
RAID. RAID is exactly like that.
But RAID is not exactly a file system because you have, I mean, RAID is a RAID.
Yeah, RAID is a block layer. But CFS is both block layer and file system, right? So they.
Mm-hmm.
They make a combination of both. So ZFS is not just alone. You have ZFS plus RAID C. So there is an
right.
underlying.
But I think the RAID C is managed by the file system itself.
That's what I'm saying.
They
so
don't. They don't have this notion of block layer, right? So,
well,
so
like
that's what I'm asking. Are there any other file system like this where you just get rid of probably Waffle. You know, get rid of the block layer and the file system manage the whole thing.
I don't know about Waffle, whether it does direct mapping for multiple disks. It might go through a RAID from what I understand.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, probably it goes through a RAID.
But I mean, for ZFS, I really see that, I mean, though they combine RAID Z and ZFS into one, you could just as equally separate these two out, right? And say, ZFS, there is one part of the ZFS that does file metadata management and all that, and the
mm-hmm.
other part of which is RAID Z that does multi-disk management.
Yeah, but, yeah, that's true. So, yeah, but my question is, are not you losing important information by separating all the...
Possibly,
those
yeah. Yeah,
and I think
separating what?
Both components, like the block part and the file system part. Right? Because, for instance, in CFS, one important thing I see that doesn't happen in a regular RAID implementation is that the RAID itself has the information of what blocks are used or not, right? And this is very important in the reconstruction of data, because now you don't have to reconstruct the whole disk, but now only the useful part. Right?
Okay. So you're talking about the file system in separate device and
yeah. File system separate the block layer and the file system in two different, very different components. Right? So yeah. So I don't know. So this was also another of my ideas, trying to think of as did CFS, right? Try to go back and see how can you, start from scratch, saying, I want to have some files, I have a bunch of disks, so now how can I, do the middle steps to have a better performance and reliability and so on. I guess somewhat similar to CFS, right?
Mm.
But I don't know, probably there is another solution ever
general. What ZFS is doing is reconstruction based on live or dead blocks. It's certainly interesting.
Yeah.
There was paper, of course, from past 2004 and about use of, building semantic disks where you use file system.
Yeah, I have that.
So they looked at several different ideas there. I mean, one of them was degrade, for instance.
Okay.
Where the idea was that if you lose a disk, then, let's say you do not have RAID 5, you have RAID 0, and you lose a disk, you lose everything. You don't have access to the file system, and their argument was that you should still have access to the file system proportional to the amount of space that you lost. So how do you separate out metadata and data dependencies in the RAID indirection mechanism so that you can still have availability of some file system data despite disk loss. So So that, so Ramsey's group has looked at this idea before.
Yeah, okay.
That's interesting. Yeah, the SDS work. And there are several projects based on this idea of using knowledge of file system inside the disk.
Okay. And RAID. But those are in the subsequent path or some other components?
Most of them are in path. Okay. There are some which are outside. But yeah, most of them.
So that way I had an idea, I think I talked to you one time about that, is that, so let's say you have a RAID 1 with 4 disks.
RAID 1?
Yeah.
So you have like 4 copies?
No. You have 2 copies of each.
Okay.
Sorry, one copy of each. It's just, you have 2 drives that are mirror of 2 other drives.
Oh, 1-0.
Yeah, something like, RAID 1-0.
Yeah, RAID 1-0, right?
Uh-huh.
Let's suppose that you have that, right? So you have one failure, up to 2 device, probably up to 2 specific device failures. Right, so the idea is that probably if you have a RAID 1-0 and one disk fails, so you can automatically build a RAID 4 from those devices that you have and then still provide another additional disk failure.
RAID 4.
Yeah.
Or RAID 5.
Well, they're both about the same thing in terms of...
With RAID 4, you don't have distributed parity.
But probably RAID 4 is easier to build.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but you cannot build a RAID 5. It's about the same thing. But the thing is that, so if you have some drives, probably, and you have some RAID configuration, and drives start to fail, and probably you don't have time to do changes, then yes, adapt to a RAID scheme that minimizes the amount of information that you lose. Probably by having less priority or whatever. Because for instance, if you have a RAID 6 and one drive fails, you're automatically running in some degrade mode,
mm-hmm.
right? That you're doing additional work, but if you have a RAID 6, and then you pass that RAID 6 to a RAID 5, then you're running automatically on a normal mode, without having any, and probably having a better performance than that of having your RAID 6 running on degrade mode.
I think that was the idea behind RAID DB, RAID parity, which uses RAID 5 and then builds RAID 6 on top of RAID 5. So if you lose one disk, you go back to RAID 5. You might want to look at RAID DB.
Okay.
The idea of moving from 3 disk RAID 01 to RAID 4, there might have been work on that as well. I mean, there is this...
What year is that? Sorry?
RAID DB?
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about like...
That's old. I think that's you know...
Yeah.
No, it's not that old actually. So... Maybe 5 years old, like.
Okay.
But there were other... you know, there is this auto RAID work. I don't know if you can leave auto RAID.
Yeah, but auto RAID is different.
Auto RAID is a different idea, but there were lots of papers in that time about how to migrate between RAID levels and things like that. So, those, a lot of them may actually be theoretical work, which basically propose the idea and then do some theoretical analysis and that sort of work. Okay, so... Right. So, Sajid, do you have anything to discuss?
Yeah, I have some intuitive idea. I haven't thought about that very, very concretely. So my idea is that the idea I borrow is striking in my mind when Ricardo was explaining the Core paper.
Mm.
Like the multi-core system.
Mm-hmm.
Like so, so multi-core systems, you know that as everybody knows that is getting very important, and it's becoming more important in when the virtualization comes into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more important in the virtualized environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have read some of the articles that they say that multi-core. It is because virtualization can benefit a lot from the multi-core environment. So, so what I'm trying to do is that some kind of profiling on the virtual machine's performance as you increase the number of cores or you do some changes in the processor alignment. So,
what do you mean by processor alignment?
Because you know that the Core paper say that if you place something very in the middle core.
The middle core, what does that mean?
It's that these processors are aligned sequentially, so C0, C1, C2, sorry, the cores are aligned
mm-hmm.
sequentially. So if you place it in the middle core, you'll get more benefit in terms of access time.
The core?
Middle
core? I don't get it. I mean, the cores are in a matrix, right?
Yeah.
You know, but the thing that since so here's a processor. Let's say here's a processor has three cores, right? So if this one and each one has, let's say,
the
this round thing is the cache, right? So you have a line here, here, and here, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you put it on the middle core, you can access the three caches more quickly than if you put it here. Here you can access this cache quickly, this one takes a little more, and this one takes a little more.
Really?
That's what you're saying, right?
I do remember now reading something about that. How many hops you have to go to fetch your cache.
Those
are only true for one, for some, for either AMD or Intel, but not both.
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on the architecture, and design
on the
processor.
Design,
yeah.
Well, it's not that process. Every processor does that.
I'm not sure.
The result they show is for the AMD. Yeah.
Mm. Okay, so let's say that you have.
So I want to do some kind of analysis that how the performance changes in the virtualized environment. Specifically to the selection of core, how important it is to the performance.
Mm.
And also, actually, in a broader sense, it's some kind of platform management modeling. So based on your application needs or the kind of application you're running, you do some kind of modeling of what kind of architecture you probably need. And there is also another trend that the Core graph says that if you give too many cores, it doesn't mean that your performance is going to improve a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of...
So when you say give too many cores, you say allocate many cores to one virtual machine.
One virtual machine doesn't mean that the performance will improve.
The Core paper, does it talk about virtual machines at all?
No, it doesn't talk about, but it talk about
processes. No, processes.
It's the same thing, right? If you consider a VM as a process.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is this trend in the architectural world that they are pushing towards having asymmetric CPUs. What that means is that you have different cores that work at different speeds. So probably one core is more powerful than the other ones.
So not SMP.
No, they're not SMP. They're ASMP or whatever. I don't know. And the thing is that having that, you can probably do smarter positioning of VMs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also the, you know, the last discussion we were talking about the cache size impact.
Mm. So, is there an impact on the cache size on the performance of an application?
Mm-hmm.
And in virtualization environment, is more important, especially when your I/O is diverted to a DOM 0. Because all the processing is done by DOM 0 when it's I/O intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the importance of the cache size in that sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, everything is converted to DOM 0 and you have the single processor handling all those stuff, especially now Zen and all those virtualization companies are pushing for architecture that's for only for I/O. So you have the I/O architecture that does all the processing.
Mm-hmm.
On behalf of on I/O.
Mm-hmm.
So you have separate CPU for I/O.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make this more efficient, using the same CPU for DOM 0 or other kind of operations, you divert everything to a processor architecture.
Yeah.
So a lot of this, it depends on the architecture itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of this work potentially depends on the architecture. Yes, so my point is that if you say that everything is architecture dependent, every virtualization solution is also somehow architecture dependent.
Yeah, I'm not saying that we should not build architecturally dependent solutions, but what I'm saying is that for that you have to have a good knowledge of architecture and look at what is going on in the architectural conferences, where the research is heading. And for to be cutting edge in that space, you have to look at conferences like ISCA, ASLAS,
mm-hmm.
Where all the multi-core new ideas and multi-core architectures are being proposed and discussed. Unfortunately, I do not have much expertise in that direction. I mean, though I should probably start reading up more and more, because multi-core is here to stay and it's going to continue to be around for probably at least a decade, and we don't know when the trends change again. But I sort of find myself a little ill-equipped to approach this sort of research. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing it. Certainly it would require more work.
We can start some initial experimenting based on that. If we have one multiprocessor, multi-core machine,
mm-hmm.
we can start doing experiments that we talked about last time, that we haven't thought to really do some really micro benchmarks based on how the pinning of codes to a particular VM.
Mm.
So is it very efficient or is it not?
Mm. Yeah. Now, so the thing is, of course, there's always this dilemma, right? That you have built expertise in a certain area of research, and you want to, as much as possible, leverage that. But if you start doing the same sort of things again and again, then maybe you're doing very incremental stuff. If you want to move into a different area, it's possible chance of return, you then have to compete with others who are probably already spent a lot of time in that area, right? So there is always this balance that needs to be carefully considered. How much extra effort does it require to be competitive in a new field? I would not be surprised that people in the multi-core, you know, sort of multi-core systems research have already been looking at some of these problems. Like spinning of VMs to cores and things like that. But it's still relatively new, I think, so there may not be a whole bunch of people in that space. But in terms of expertise, there may be other people more who qualified to do that kind of work than us, in some sense. So that's my concern there.
But I was thinking that if I have to be an expert on virtualization, I need to have some kind of architecture study, for sure. Because a lot of virtualization innovations and the trends is very much dependent on the architecture, just like I/O architecture.
Yeah, so I'm not saying that we shouldn't be doing this, but certainly
It also means that we are competing potentially with some experts. So that also means we have to put in more hard work so that we reach to that level of knowledge, which is the state of the art. In terms of taking an experiment-driven approach, which is, well, let's try something, let's buy a machine with multi-core and try some experiments, that's reasonable, but I think that has to be only secondary. That can only be secondary to actually gaining fundamental knowledge. And so, yeah, I would encourage you to look at Astlos and ISCA over the last 3 years or so,
especially on multi-core,
especially on multi-core work, and see what they have. Micro also, symposium of micro architecture.
So that, isn't that more like electronics?
Does HPCA?
They also do some systems work.
Sure, you want to look at
HPCA?
HPCA, yes.
This last year was very, very, very architecture. This next one.
You mean 2009? 2009.
Very, very architecture.
So Astlos is completely architecture.
Well, it is safe architectural support for programming languages and operating systems. So there are some OS papers there sometimes.
Yeah, I guess it depends on whatever they say.
The one thing which I wanted to say is that, for instance, Lewis, in your idea that just came to my mind, is that there are two different types of flash, SLC and MLC,
mm-hmm.
which have different performance and cost trade-offs.
Yeah.
So I think the SLC is the one that's more expensive, but also more high performance.
More high performance and less, it has less space.
Right.
It's less bare, right?
Less dense. So that could be a SLC could be a hybrid RAM idea,
but
where MLC could be more like a disk cache. Right. So that's something to keep, you know, think about.
But I guess the current SSD devices mix both of them, right?
No, actually, no.
It's just MLC
separate.
Or
yes, you have one device either MLC or SLC, but no combination.
Oh no, there was a paper in Speed that a guy talked about hybrid.
No.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's where I was. And that guy has some joint work with Samsung, so probably those type of devices are coming up.
Maybe, yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I do remember now. The Speed, we have that. Any other thoughts, Sajid?
No, I don't have much time.
Okay. So, Ricardo, did you have anything else to talk about? Or?
Yeah, there's something, but
did you give further thought to this I/O pipelining stuff?
Yeah, I don't like it.
You don't like it?
there's some problems with it. But something else was that the idea of extending the block interface. I guess nobody likes the block interface. It's poor. Right?
Okay.
At least I don't like it. The idea of having a linear address for these, for SSDs, for RAID, for SAN, for everything it's poor. We're losing too much information. So the question is, what if you could add more information or at least one more dimension into this address space? Let's say you have a two-dimensional address space, for example. So the question would be, what could be made better if you had two-dimensional address spaces, for example, if you had a nice smart mapping between from the disk layout to a b-dimensional address space, you can do, I guess, I'm sure you could do better scheduling, better allocation. The same if you have a b-dimensional address space to represent arrays of disks, in which each disk represents a dimension and each other linear address space in a disk is the other dimension. I guess you could also do smarter things. What if SAN, instead of provide a linear address space, provided a two- or three-dimensional address space? What could you do? So we'll be at work with many stages. One stage will be mapping of device layouts to multidimensional other spaces. The other will be scheduling of multidimensional spaces. And the other will be even file system design, because you couldn't use inodes like as they are anymore. You need to point instead of device. LBA, you need to point to device, set of LBA statement too if it's two dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what could you do if you had a couple of dimensions, of at least one dimension into this thing. But the point is that the interface is poor. That's the thing. And everybody knows the dimension is good, but nobody proposed anything new.
So, Ricardo, what kind of information you can put into dimensional?
Bidimensional. For example, if you represent a disk instead of a linear thing, you represent it in a bidimensional thing.
Or you need three dimensions.
Or maybe a three-dimensional. I'm sure you could. I don't have any example in mind, but I'm sure you could do better things.
I guess you can. An example would be
multi-dimensional.
Y, you have the cylinder number, and in the X, you have the sector number in that cylinder.
Well, at least having a framework and then specific mappings for some devices. I'm sure there's something
yeah.
smart can be done.
But then, I guess this before the block interface. Were like that, right? You have three dimensions.
Four dimensions.
Cylinder, track, and sector.
Right.
So
even another dimension could be time.
So
right?
Multi-dimensional.
Yeah.
Dimensions.
So okay. So well, I would say that probably it's a good idea to look for why. There was this move from having this three-dimensional.
I think to simplify, you always design.
Yeah. To LBA, right? Because probably going back, or this idea of going back would be answered by that.
Yeah.
Kind of definition.
Yeah, that's true. So now, let's say we move on into this work. I guess it would be like two types of work. Like
so,
what? One would be some very shallow, very small study of what could you do, what would be the benefits. Another would be actually going to deeply and actually design mapping algorithms, design scheduling algorithms, design a file system to take into account these things. So, I don't know, that's basically the idea.
So the thing is that, for instance, what would happen if you have random access devices?
For random access devices, you wouldn't get any. I mean, another dimension could be, for example, for an SSD, would be what is the, you have dices, you have some.
No, but I'm talking about this abstract thing that has random, completely random access.
Completely random access. I guess you don't gain anything in that case. For this perspective. I mean,
and who will take care of handling the dimension? Because let's say you have a device that has two dimensions and another one that has six.
Okay, so let's say you map everything into two dimensions. The six dimensional thing will have to map into two dimensions. At least it's better than mapping to a one dimensional.
No, no, yeah.
I guess you can have a fixed. Well, I'm thinking of having a fixed amount of, or maximum amount of dimensions, right?
Yeah.
You say that you have eight dimensions.
Yeah.
So if you only need three dimensions, you set
part
of
dimensions
to add one, to be one, right? So I guess that's easily solvable. But even, I guess the questions still...
Yeah, well, I mean, those questions are the answer. I mean, the answer to those questions are the work, the actual research.
So, yeah, but the thing is, my question is, who will make this mapping and who will maintain this map? I mean, because eventually, probably you will need to translate that into a one-dimensional mapping, because all the other...
I mean, no,
because traditionally, memory is accessed one dimension and whatever.
I mean, that's one case, but what I'm proposing is moving the multi-dimensional layer interface to all the layers of the storage in there. from the disk controller to the block layer to the file system, everything.
What you're saying is map.
Yeah, but what then eventually you will reach the CPU, and the CPU is still one dimension.
No, but wait, because you can map the, let's say, one byte of one file to three dimensions, right? That's fine.
Yeah,
I guess that's where.
But you're not talking about moving all the way up to the CPU. You're
I'm aiming at the storage device, at the I/O.
So you're saying that, okay, so the file system provides this one dimension.
The file system provides a file interface.
A file interface.
Yeah.
And from the file system down, you have
an I/O will not point anymore to a specific device. Linear address.
Yeah.
You point to a device, multiple
linear dimensions.
To
this X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing that needs to be done for this work is to make the case for having multiple dimensions in the first place. Then you can think about, well, how can I, design some interesting optimizations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so what are these dimensions? What are the logical dimensions to have? And why is it important to separate this dimension from this other dimension, which would otherwise be together?
I think the problem about having multiple dimensions is that design gets a lot more complicated. I remember that some time back, I think in the 80s or 90s, there was this hypercube or cubic CPUs developed by, I think, IBM or something like that. Basically, it was something like what is now multi-core, but the data model was completely different. Was a multi-dimensional access model, and instructions were something very weird. And eventually, I think that failed because it was too complicated to make. For us humans to map things into multiple dimensions.
Okay, so we won't map more than two dimensions.
But you mean
for compilers to map.
Yeah, for compilers.
Programs into multiple dimensions of instructions. I wouldn't get discouraged because of that, because that's a completely different level of abstraction, right? I mean, that's at the instruction level abstraction. But we are talking about maybe
storage.
Maybe more coarse-grained abstraction, and there are people who have been proposing modifying the interface. You're proposing it for possibly performance alone. So you might want to also think about, well, can these dimensions be used for other metrics as well, for improving something else like, say, reliability or security?
But I think Luis's question is very valid. To ask the one about why, if this existed before, why doesn't it exist now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one thing about the past history I can say is that this change from three-dimensional disk interface to one-dimensional logical space happened when we were using single disk systems. At that time, there was no RAID. So the interface already got standardized before we started using multi-disk systems in machines. And at that point, no one decided to question the interface when we started building multi-disk systems, because maybe there was so much history of fighting, and finally everyone agreed on something, and
just leave it like that.
That they just want to leave it like that. And having said that, there are people questioning disk interface all the time. And I mean, now we have this transactional flash as well. Right, which recent paper for flash devices. There are new devices. It is certainly valid to question
range
disk interface.
Range-wise
also questioning disk interface. It's certainly valid to question the disk interface, given that we have so many changes in the recent past. And I would not get discouraged because of past failures in other domains.
I guess that's fine. What I'm just saying is that, just to check what happened there, and to see if that still holds, right? Or not. And if it doesn't apply, then
you can
probably get some new ideas.
You mean why change it back?
No. Why change it from 3 to 1? I would definitely like to know why.
Yeah,
but the feeling, I mean, that's the feeling I have about anything storage at the block layer. It's just such complex layers mapped to this stupid one linear. It's an extreme. It's
yeah.
too much.
So
it's
probably your point is that, okay, let's simplify the block devices and let them not be intelligent.
They could be intelligent. They still need to map to whatever number of interfaces of dimensions we have. But they still need to do some smart things.
Like what?
Like invalidating some blocks.
Yeah, but
like remapping.
But the way I'm seeing it is that probably the way I saw it was that you were taking a level of indirection out. You are taking the level of indirection handled by the device and handling yourself in the.
No. The controller, the disk controller, can do these smart things, like that remapping bad blocks. That is a very smart thing. The only thing I'm saying is that you have multi-dimensions. You have how do you call it?
So the disk controllers also use single-dimensional address, right?
Yeah,
definitely.
Disk controller. You are talking about remapping of inside disk firmware, not controller.
Yes.
These controllers do things like automatic indirection, if it's a hardware RAID controller, or rebuilding, and those kind of things. This controller.
But its address is only a single address, right?
Linear address. Yes.
But that's the thing. At least for me now, it's nothing serious. I don't know. I haven't seen numbers or anything.
Mm.
Just the feeling I have is. A complex layout map into a very simple.
But how do you extract more information if this controller doesn't know?
The thing is that this interface provides this.
Yeah.
Not you extracting that information. It's just this provided by the disk.
That's the thing I hate the most, having to infer information about another layer because the interface is poor. I hate that outside of computing. Nobody should be doing that.
doesn't like geometry, maybe.
No. It's the idea of providing simple interfaces and these gray box things.
But the thing is that the software engineering people always want to be simpler in
layer things.
Yeah.
It's just to make you feel more comfortable about the abstraction. That's why you need abstraction, right?
So you don't like software engineering people?
The thing is that if you want to make the case for multi-dimensional block interface, then you have to look at, well, how would you map this block interface to, let's say, two different devices, flash and disk, and then how can I utilize that flexibility now I have because of these two dimensions?
Yes.
So I think it's worth pursuing this idea, certainly. Because I.O. is still expensive. And if there is any way to optimize I.O., I think... people will still pay attention. Maybe a lot of them will say, well, this is not practical, but we are not in the business of creating standards or building products.
Yes, of course.
We are in the business of
research,
of challenging existing approaches and suggesting new directions. Now, whether the community takes up after that or not is...
That's the good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still couldn't understand, I mean, how you can give this controller a multidimensional address.
No, so instead of saying LBA and read or write and size, I will say LBA 1, LBA 2, read or write and size.
Yeah,
so I just supply two numbers.
Sector, cylinder, and...
Not sector, cylinder. These are two dimensions. We don't know how they map it.
Mapping could be...
Not exact, no.
That would be an example of a mapping. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But
so
that's just similar to the range write, right? You give a bunch of addresses.
Yeah. No.
Range rights is always
different.
It's still in the single dimension. You say start position, and in the same dimension, how much to read or write, or in the sort of the same dimension, you're specifying starting and ending point. Here we are saying we have two distinct dimensions which map to two different types of characteristics of this device space. Right.
Yeah. I guess
converting this mapping, this type of two dimensional, multi dimensional, to a deep only single dimension.
That's the mapping problem that needs to be addressed. So
you
create these dimensions based on that mapping, and a mapping which is actually useful to improve performance or improve reliability or whatever.
So even if you deem this high-level my dimension in the block layer. The disk controller would again also, but disk controller still use only single level addressing, right?
No, so he's saying that the disk controller also changes.
Okay.
Its interface. The disk maybe changes its interface. So change interface all over the stack.
Oh,
throughout the stack.
Throughout. You need to have changes throughout, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise you cannot do it.
Yeah.
So that was my biggest concern.
Maybe the disk interface remains the same, the controller interface changes. That could be possible.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I would certainly explore that.
So another question, I guess, is well, right now you one can assume that the next block in the LDA will be the fastest to access, right?
Yeah.
So in these two dimensions would be the closest.
One nice thing would be for a disk that the two-dimensional thing could represent somehow, could help for, let's say, rotational hour schedule.
Okay.
Things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extra information that can be used for something.
You cannot use the closest distance. It's very different. It depends on how this platter moves.
But probably you can use polar coordinates, you know? Polar coordinates match with circular.
Yeah, but all right. So I think we need to stop now because
it's
we have
3 already.
Yeah, it's almost 3.
Almost
okay, and
15 minutes.
Okay, I think I was looking at your watch. Okay.
My wife is always
fast. Okay. So let's. You were saying let's finish that thought, but we should stop soon.
What I'm saying is that. When you're talking about the polar coordinates, okay, this is the thing, you have coordinates x1, y1, x2, y2. So, the distance, and you have x3, y3.
Mm-hmm.
So, even if the distance, the coordinate distance between these two is
you mean
smaller,
Euclidean distance?
The Euclidean distance is smaller than this.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in terms of peak movement, this is actually more intense.
Sure.
Right?
So yeah, probably that direction you're rotating on or something like that. That's
the challenge because, the mapping from the two-dimensional space to something that is physical is a challenge, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the two dimensions are just as simple as disk ID and LBA within that disk. Then it becomes simple. But at least now we know how many disks are in the RAID and things like that, right? Yeah.
So I guess the mapping will be very challenging.
Yeah. Coming up with a mapping that's useful is the challenging part.
And the mapping will change across devices, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, guys.
So let me finish by saying something. It doesn't have to, it's not a big idea.